Well, good morning, everybody. We seem to have solved our technical problems. At least we actually didn't have a technical problem, and then one was created so that it could be solved. But that's part of the full employment for hotel workers or whatever. It's a tremendous pleasure today to introduce our Carl Taube Award winner, Mary Evans. I was delighted when she asked me to do this. I've been an officer in the Mary Evans fan club for years, because and have known her for, I think, probably 15 or 20 years or something like that. And interacting with Mary has always been an enormous pleasure. In getting ready to do this little introduction, I thought it would be good to look at Mary's CV, and I asked her to email it to me. And I was working on this on Friday, and naturally, because I put everything off till the last minute, and I said, well, I guess I'll print it out. And I thought, I looked at the paper supply in my printer at home, and I thought, well, this should be more than enough. And then I realized that actually Mary's CV is 53 pages, and I only had, I think, about 45 pages. So certain parts of her career, I guess, I'm not really aware of. But I think I had seen enough to come to the conclusion that Mary deserves this award. There were a number of things that I think that are really interesting about her career. Mary, unlike some people who, you know, went to, you know, did the traditional undergraduate psychology or sociology major and then got a PhD in public health or sociology or psychology, Mary has a somewhat different career path. Mary began her career as a nurse. She was an actual healthcare provider, and I believe an Army nurse at that. I think when the Mary Evans story is made into a movie, Loretta Swit will be the natural person to play her. That was your nickname? Mary began her mental health career at least from what I can tell until the paper ran out in my printer, at the Office of Mental Health in New York. And this is, I think, significant because, like so many people who have really left a mark on the field of mental health services research, I think involvement in public agencies is really the public mental health, the public health mission of mental health services research in many ways. And Mary was part of that early cohort of people, many of whom are in this room, Joe Morrissey and Hank Stedman all the people who decided that they wanted to move to Florida or North Carolina or some, versus those people who decided to stay up north. But that was a pioneering group of people and really forged our field. And Mary was part of that group. I think Mary also left a tremendous mark in the area of child, or has made a tremendous mark in the area of child mental health services research. I think it was noted a couple of years ago by someone that child mental health services research has lagged behind adult services research a little bit, partly because it wasn't immediately recognized as being perhaps as important or as easy to do or whatever as adult services research was, and that many of the people who went into that area were people who had been adult services researchers, and Mary was one of those. She brought her expertise and interest to child mental health services research and has really been a mainstay in that area for years and years. I think, you know, there are lots of good mental health services researchers, many of whom are members of our section, and many of whom are in this room. I think that the ones who we've honored with the Taube Award, and many of them are sitting here, Joe Morrissey, Don Steinwachs, Dave Shern, I'm sure there are other people that my myopia doesn't allow me to actually see that far, but who have made tremendous contributions. But one of the things that these people have done, in addition to the stellar work that they've done, the grants they've gotten, the publications they've had, is that they have been enormous resources for the field and for others coming up in the field. And I think there are a few people about whom that can be said, that it's for whom it's more true than for Mary. This is one of the things that doesn't come through on the 53-page CV, or only maybe to a small extent, that she's been on dozens of PhD dissertations, that she's been a consultant on grants with some big-time people, but also with some people who are just starting out. Mary's one of those people who's been willing to sign on to grants as a co-investigator with a person, and to do a lot of work on a grant application that she probably recognizes is not one that has a high chance of getting funded, but that she feels obligated to help in knowing that this is the way a field develops and prospers. I think she's one of the people who, if you follow her around during any of these kinds of meetings, the number of people that will grab her and say, "Hey, can I talk to you for a couple of minutes?" Those are not the kinds of things that one measures, but those are the immeasurable contributions in our field, and I think that we honor that when we give the Carl Tobe Award to people like Mary. I think another major contribution of Mary's is the really largely thankless job of her work on the NIMH study section. I know that the pay is that, you know, people do this for the money and because it's just really so much fun. Anybody who has been on study section or who has done an ad hoc review or who has had Mary as their contact person after their grant has been totally trashed knows that. That Mary's oversight and participation in that process is one of the things that's made it at least as humane a process as possible. And her willingness to also keep a room full of very large egos under control and keep them focused functioning in a way that benefits the people whose grants they're reviewing is also an immeasurable contribution to the field. So for all those reasons, for her work in public mental health services research, her work in public mental health services, her work in mental health services research, her pioneering work in child mental health services, and her consistent and congenial mentoring, we honor Mary Evans today with the Carl Tobe Award.
And thanks to Bill for nominating me for this award, and it's so wonderful to see so many of you that I know and have worked with in the audience today. I think that one of the things that would be really interesting if we ever have time to sit down and not work on grants together but just talk together would be for those of us who are mental health services researchers to talk about how it is that we got into this field. Because you know, when you do, when you're in school and they ask you, what do you want to be when you grow up? That's not one of the check boxes. So we've all come to it by different routes, and it'd be interesting to find out what some of those routes are. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about my route. When I was in school, I always wanted to be a nurse. From first grade, I said, I want to be a nurse. This is good. I took care of my father when he was ill. I want to be a nurse. And so, you know, it was pretty constant. When I got to high school, they start giving you these aptitude tests and these vocational interest tests. And what I found out there was something pretty shocking to me. I should have been either a forest ranger or a garage mechanic. The things that I should never do, never, ever do, are education, social work, or nursing. So you can see how much attention I paid to that. But something interesting happened to me that really put me on the trajectory where I am now, even though I started as a nurse in a diploma program. And that is this. At 17, I entered nursing school, and one of our first assignments was to do microbiological cultures of the world in which we live. And so lots of my classmates took all their tubes and their swabs and everything, and they went around and they cultured the environment in which we live. So they did the refrigerator, and some really disgusting stuff turned up there. They did toothbrushes, they did the telephone, they did the bathrooms that we shared in common, more disgusting stuff showed up. But I didn't do that. I want to show you what I did. Do you know what this is? Uh-huh. This is a bedpan sterilizer. Okay? So I thought the world in which I'm going to live as a nurse is in the hospital. And patients are getting infections all the time in the hospital. And we have these critters in the wall. And they're supposed to sterilize the bedpans. And so, you know, patients won't get infected in their wounds or whatever. So I ask all my classmates, whenever you use the bedpan sterilizer and the bedpan is sterilized, you call me and I'll run upstairs with my test tubes and my swabs, and I am going to swab and see what we can grow. Well, I found that half of the bedpan sterilizers in the hospital were not sterilizing. They were growing some pretty interesting and some pretty malignant kinds of organisms. And so I said, well, I have an obligation at this point in time since I know this. So I sent a note. I'm 17 years old, remember, and I'm scared to death being in the hospital. I sent a note to the director of nursing, and I said, half of your bedpan sterilizers are not working, and I have the data to show it. And she must have taken a deep breath and said, okay. Because pretty soon, workmen started showing up on the floors and started to fix these bedpan sterilizers. And so that's how I got interested in applied research or policy-relevant research, because I was 17 and I made a difference. And so that's kind of how I got into this business. After that, I went into another whole role entirely. In fact, I probably would have become a microbiologist. I was really hot for that stuff after that study. But because of financial situations and because I had already said I wanted to be a nurse for so long, I went ahead and became a nurse. After graduation, 5 days after I graduated from my program, I went to Temple University to begin to get a bachelor's degree. And I must say, it wasn't because I really wanted to study more nursing, is because I really missed in the diploma education things like English literature. And so I started taking all these English literature courses and science courses and such. And I did a study when I was working for my bachelor's degree that, again, I was curious about from my diploma education. Before we could graduate from the diploma program, we had to pass 5 exams, or specialty exams, pediatrics, obstetrics, et cetera, et cetera. And if you didn't pass those, they wouldn't graduate you from the program. Well, these exams were supposed to be predictive of how well you would do on the licensing exam after you graduated. And, of course, my Lankenau Hospital School of Nursing did not want anybody failing the licensing exam and looking bad for them, so they made us pass these tests. Well, I wondered whether or not these tests were predictive. So I went to the National League of Nursing and I said, I want some data from you. I'd like data on approximately 3,000 nurses on these examinations and on their licensing exam. And I'm going to see whether or not this really is predictive. And indeed, it was predictive, which made me feel a whole lot better about the tutoring I had done for the students who had not been passing their exams when we were in school. So again, I was kind of hooked on prediction and learning about things, testing things, and then went to work. I did a whole bunch of other kinds of studies that I'm not going to talk about in detail. Things like a needs assessment for nursing programs in upstate New York, priorities for research in nursing in New York State. And one of the things I was really interested in has to do with role models. How do students get socialized to the profession of nursing, and who are their role models? And at the time, there were a lot of studies that were being done in medicine and many, many fewer studies in nursing. So I decided to do some data collection about the beliefs about role models in 259 BSN students and 35 faculty members. And this is what I found, which is kind of interesting. The faculty saw themselves as role models, but fewer than half of the students did. We think we're doing well, they think we're not doing well. Faculty believed the ideal role model would be staff nurses. Well, students chose faculty, okay? So we aren't doing well at all. When I was working in this particular program, I was the only nurse faculty who actually practiced nursing. The others were practicing academics. So I was working in emergency rooms at the same time and working on my doctorate and all those other kinds of things. But I could understand why students told us what they told us about role modeling. Both, however, believe that a broad clinical background and actually giving care were important. And I think this has all kinds of implications for the way we continue to teach some of these health professions, especially now where nursing faculty have large numbers of students on clinical units or multiple clinical units and don't get to spend a lot of time with the students. When I went to work for the Office of Mental Health, my first assigned study was to look at therapy aids and to try to figure out what made a successful therapy aid. So we're back into the prediction business again. And at the time, the New York State Office of Mental Health had 23,000 therapy aides, so we had lots to choose from. They were selected for their positions by a civil service examination, but we knew nothing about the relationship between the civil service examination and the actual performance of therapy aides. And so Joe Kokoza and I started some of this work, and I continued it after Joe moved on to another job. What we used were supervisors' evaluations, standardized instruments such as the Opinions About Mental Illness by Cohen and Struning. We used employment records, we used the exam scores, we used interviews with both supervisors and therapy aides. And one of the things that we found was that a successful aide is female and a high school graduate and probably a mother. Okay, these were nurturing people who were being rated as successful in their positions. But we learned some other things too. For example, the factor most strongly related to time and attendance, which is important in your evaluation, is your attitude towards your supervisor. You have a negative attitude, you're going to be taking a lot of time off and not showing up for work or being late for work. The other factors that were related to tenure were, reasonably enough, older age, a family member that worked for the Office of Mental Health. Lower civil service exam scores. Now, the civil service people did not like this finding, okay? I can tell you that. They did not like this finding. But it was true. And those folks were more likely to perceive their community as working class. So rather than suburbanites who saw themselves as middle class or professional, they had more positive attitudes toward clients than the people who were not rated as successful. And they were more likely to believe, and I think this is important, that they could influence the environment. I can do something here that will make life better for these people. I know how to do that. Sorry. Here are some of our recommendations. First of all, these people were never exposed to the work setting before they were hired. So the first day they were put on the unit was kind of a shock to them, and in some places more of a shock than others. So we suggested that they needed some tours of the facilities, they needed to see what the units were like, they needed to be on a unit for a while, and that the whole orientation process needed to be changed. Secondly, and in conjunction with the folks in the civil service, we identified a group of near passers, those who had, for example, from 60 to 70 in their score, and some who had just passed 70 to 80 in their score and had been hired. And we decided to give them a special orientation program, a special educational program, to see what would happen and follow those people up over time, which is what we did. And we found that the near passers were really excited to get this job. They wanted this job a lot. They worked hard in their educational program, and they actually were rated eventually as more successful than the people who had passed the exam to begin with. Again, civil service is looking at me saying, okay, now what do we do? And one of the things that I suggested that they do is they should add into their civil service exam something about attitudes toward clients. How do I feel about human services, or should I really be a garage mechanic, right? Those are the kinds of things I think that they needed to do, and they did do some of that. Next on docket, again, at the request of the Office of Mental Health, the first study, the therapy aid study, was actually federally funded. This study was not federally funded. This one was funded by the Office of Mental Health. This was in the last time we had a nurse shortage in the 1980s. And nurses were turning over quite frequently in employment with the Office of Mental Health. And they wanted to know why. So they said, can you find out why for us? And can you make some suggestions about how we can keep these people? So I said, yes, but first I want to know why you think they're leaving employment with the Office of Mental Health. And the people in the HR department told me, well, we think they're moving with their spouses. Most of these are women, and they're moving because their husbands go to school or they get a job somewhere else, and so that's how come we've got turnover. And I said, okay, we'll see if that's a reason or if that's not a reason. So we interviewed 135 nurses who had recently left employment with the Office of Mental Health. And here's what we found. The reasons for leaving: the unit is understaffed. There's concern about patient violence. There had been a really high-profile case in which a nurse had been attacked by a patient and really injured very badly. They were dissatisfied with the salary. They're dissatisfied with their input into clinical and administrative decision-making. They didn't feel they had autonomy, and nobody listened to them. Okay? Very different than they moved with their husbands because they went somewhere else. And one of the questions that we asked, and I really loved the answer to it by one of the people, was, what would have kept you working at XPC, at X Psychiatric Center? And the person said, if I died and they buried me on the grounds, I'd still be at the psychiatric center. Well, the people on the 8th floor of the Office of Mental Health did not want that made public. So you can understand why. When I agreed to do this study about why they were leaving employment, I said, I will only do this study under one condition, and that is if I can do a study on why nurses stay employed so we can use the positive to try and really influence the nurses' tenure with the Office of Mental Health. So I'll tell you a little bit about that. We used a multidimensional scaling approach, and we surveyed nurses who were employed in the Office of Mental Health. The great thing about studying nurses, by the way, if you ever want to do this, is you get a large return rate. 98% of the people we said, would you be interested in this study, said, oh, sure, I'd be interested in this study, and you know, actually filled out our forms and talked to us. Some of the most important factors, two most important factors, were autonomy. I feel I can make a difference. I'm a professional. I can make decisions. Those decisions count. They're going to make patients' lives better. And excellent colleagues. I like the people I work with. They're really good people. They know what they're doing. Okay, those are the two things. So what we did as a result of that is we developed and evaluated three pilot programs to try and build on these positive aspects of employment with the Office of Mental Health. And then I'm not going to talk about the three programs today, but we followed up and evaluated those programs and the success of those programs. The other thing we did was I worked with people in HR who, by the way, did not know I was a nurse at the time that I conducted this study, because Hank Stedman had told me when he hired me into this job that you're not going to be evaluated as a nurse while you're here. You're going to be evaluated as a sociologist. So I put on my best sociology hat and did this kind of work. And so they were kind of surprised at the end when I told them, I think I can help you with building a career ladder because you know I am a nurse. So we built a career ladder for nursing, and I think that that made a big difference because we had done some other small studies that showed that the nurses with higher education, the nurses who were in more responsible positions, were actually much more satisfied with their jobs and much more likely to stay in their positions. Not surprising. But data helps sometimes in really moving this thing forward. after that, we did a number of other kinds of studies, at psychiatric emergency services, for example. For one weekend, we studied all the people who came into psychiatric emergency rooms in New York City. Who are these people? How did they get there? What's wrong with them? What happened to them? Did they go into inpatient care? Did they get given a bus token and told to go home, which happened with some of them? So we did a number of those. And we found some interesting things, I think, about the decisions about admitting or not admitting or referring to outpatient settings. And these are some of the things. And again, probably not surprising, but again, the data helped, and I'll show you how. Dangerous behavior was a reason for referral. That meant they were likely to go into inpatient, the severity of the disorder into inpatient. The hospital where the patient presented, and I know, Steve, you and I, for a number of years, every time we did a study, the place where the services is given is really important. And it's a large black box. We know very little about what's in that black box, but there it is. It's something that I think we need to pay more attention to. Current signs of psychosis meant you went into the hospital and diagnosis of a major mental disorder. And the interactions, of course, among these variables, the more of these risk factors, if you will, that you had, the more likely it was that you were going to be placed into an inpatient setting. So sitting down and talking with program people about this actually resulted in the design of a new model of emergency services for New York City, and that was the Comprehensive Psychiatric Emergency Program within general hospital settings, CPEP as we called it. And then we did some additional studies to look at the effectiveness of that CPEP model. The model provided specialized assessment, stabilization, and referral services, so not everybody had to go into the hospital to receive services. Here's where I come up with being a child mental health services researcher. And I'm going to tell you a story about this, which David Sherman will deny. He says he doesn't remember this, but I swear to you, and Roger, Mary, I've told you this story, so you know this is true, because I told you this right after it happened. David was then in charge of the Bureau of Evaluation and Services Research, and the National Institute for Mental Health released a request for applications that state agencies partner with communities and actually conduct some studies on children's mental health. So he calls me in, and we had about 50 studies in the queue at that time that we were working on, and none of the major studies or funded studies had ever been since I was there in children's mental health. So, says he, this is a great announcement. One of the two of us has to write a grant application to apply for this funding, and it's not going to be me, he says, because the only thing I know about children is that they're shorter than adults. And I said, that's only true on average. And he said, see, you do know more about children than I do. So I had 4 weeks in which to write an application, and this is where Mary Armstrong becomes very important to me, because I knew nothing about children's mental health. I've been doing adult mental health for, you know, a number of years, probably about 10 or 12 years at that point in time. So Mary and I thought we might do something on a single point of entry for kids into service, and we started on it, but it wasn't going to work. So we had less than 4 weeks to go. And I said to Mary, well, if you could do any study, what is it that you would really like to do? And Mary had been going around the state and talking about three new services that we were offering to parents who had a child with a mental health problem. And that was the intensive case management, the crisis intervention services, and the family-based treatment, which was a treatment foster care intervention. And the interesting thing that I thought came out of her discussions with some of these people is when she told them about this treatment foster care, we give special training to these so-called professional parents. They have respite care available to them. They have some flexible service dollars available. They have some parent training. They have all these different kinds of things. Parents would come up to her and say, you know, if you gave us those resources, we could keep our kids at home. And I said to Mary, that's a testable assumption, okay? So let's see if we can test it out. Now, it shows my naivete at this point, guys, I got to tell you, because if it were easy to study, somebody would already have done it. But what did I know? So I thought it was an interesting study and we should go ahead with it, and so did Mary, and so we did. So we selected three rural counties in upstate New York. We randomly assigned kids who were designated for going out of home into family-based treatment, had been designated by interagency team, to either family-based treatment, or we said to the parents, have we got a deal for you? You can keep your kid at home and we'll wrap services around you and provide you with the support you need in order to keep your child at home. The family-based treatment, very briefly, had a family specialist with a master's degree who worked with these families. There were five treatment families, usually with one child each in the home, and one respite family. So the treatment families could take off sometime and the respite family would take over. Our family-centered intensive case management, which is FCICM to us, used a team of intensive case manager and a parent advocate. This is our first use, I think, of systematic use of a parent advocate. And that was somebody who was raising or had raised a child with a serious mental health problem. And so they had the hands-on, I've been there, I've done that kind of experience. We also added in some other things that we thought would be important. Things like instruction and parenting skills, and I'll tell you how that worked out in a little bit. Respite care, flexible service dollars, and parent support groups were all part of the things that we thought that these parents would need to keep their child at home. Okay, the purpose of the research, of course, was to test the hypothesis, or Mary's dream, about given appropriate resources and supports, parents could keep their child at home, and the outcomes would be equivalent. And being in New York State, I don't know if you remember this, Mayor, we said sometimes it's the right thing to do to pay more for services. And so the right thing we figured might be, this might cost a little bit more, but that's okay, as long as it doesn't cost about 10% more, we're going to be happy with it. These are the measures we used, and they're pretty common measures in child mental health services research. The child behavior checklist, the child and adolescent functional assessment scales, child self-esteem, which we thought was important in terms of their ability to go to school and do well, for example. Unmet needs for services checklist we had, and some of that had been developed with Steve Huss, who's present with us today. Family difficulties and strengths checklist, and the family adaptability and cohesion scales, because we thought we're not only making an impact on this child, hopefully, but also on the family and the family's ability to support that child. So we enrolled 42 children, ages 5 to 13 years. You can see 15 went into family-based treatment, 27 into FCICM. 90% were male. These were young children. That changes in adolescence. You begin to see much more females and depression coming to play, and adolescent adjustment disorders, and the gender gets more equalized. These kids had mean scores way into the clinical range on internalizing and externalizing behaviors, and their self-esteem scores were below the norm for boys that they were normed against. Majority of children were rated as having severe disruption in behavior toward others, moods and emotions, and age-appropriate role performance. Many had unmet needs. These families were very poor, most of them. And 54% of them had unstable relationships among the adults if they had more than one adult caregiver. Many of them did not. Many of them were single parent. So we looked at these kids over 12 months, and we saw that both groups were experiencing significant reductions. And in fact, in almost every intervention that we have tried over a 3 to 12 month period, kids will get better if you pay attention to them and you provide them any kind of treatment or support. Len Bickman always likes to talk about that. But we saw more favorable outcomes for children in family-centered intensive case management. And here are some of the things that we saw. They had better role performance. They improved much more in behavior toward others. Their overall functioning was better. Their externalizing behavior was decreased. Their internalizing behavior improved. We saw fewer social problems and fewer thought problems in the group where we provided this intensive in-home intervention. And the children in FBT, in family-based treatment, did not show more positive outcomes on any measure compared to the children in family-centered intensive case management. So even though it's a small sample, I think it has promise that we can actually care for these kids at home very successfully and not disadvantage them in terms of the outcomes they might be experiencing. The other good news for us was the kids in family-centered intensive case management were able to stay at home. There was one that had been placed out of home for a very brief period of time, but he was one that the folks working with the family said couldn't possibly ever be in family-centered intensive case management. His mother had mental retardation. She was a single parent. He had all kinds of acting out behaviors, and she didn't know what to do with him. So the folks working with her said, you know, you've made a mistake randomizing this child to family-centered intensive case management. And indeed, he did go out of town out of a home for a while so that we could work with the mother and really give her the skills that she needed in order to take care of him when he came back. So in looking at the money, in $1,994, the average annual cost for caring for a child in family-centered intensive case management was $18,000. And it was over $51,000 for children in family-based treatment. So not only did it not cost more, it cost less, a lot less. What we concluded is what I said, with the right family supports, we can keep these kids at home and they won't be disadvantaged. Now, some advice about what we learned, okay? Don't try it at home. This was really a very, very difficult project for us to do. First, there was slow enrollment. Well, you can imagine if your child has already been identified for going out of home and we come to you and say, have we got a deal for you? We can keep your kid at home with you. There's some parents that say, that's really a neat idea. And some would say, people have told me already, this kid's got to go away for a while. And then when he comes back, he's going to be a lot better. So this enrollment was slow. I guess if I were to do it again, and I don't know about you, Mayor, but I would choose an urban area, more kids, and possibly less time for travel for our interventionists. These were really rural communities we were using. And when we asked family-centered intensive case manager and the parent advocate, how much time do you spend on the road going from family to family? They told us 27% of their time was spent in travel. So we'd like to try this in a place where less time is put into travel and more time is actually put into working with families. We had hoped in this intervention to really understand a lot about the family support that we were providing these people and taking a look at how parenting was occurring for the other children in the family. But unfortunately for us, the target child, the one that was enrolled in our study, was usually the oldest child in the family. And so there weren't ways of measuring for these very, very young children the kind of effect that this parental support and parental training might have on them. We also learned that working with schools is really, really hard. And any of you that do it deserve a gold medal. Obtaining teacher ratings was one of our most difficult things. It's too bad because this is where kids are receiving a lot of services and how we judge whether or not kids are doing well. How are they doing in school? That's their job. To get through school and to learn. And also, we learned a little bit about parent training, that it must be responsive to the current difficulties the parent is experiencing. And I'll tell you a little bit about that. We used a group called People Places in Staunton, Virginia, who was training the professional family members in the FBT. And we said, can you modify your training program for parents? And they said, yeah, we think we can do that. We work a lot with parents. And so they sat down and they did a training program, which we then taught to the family-centered intensive case managers. And so the case managers would take their binder with them and they go into the family's home and they'd open it up and they'd say, okay, now we're going to try and give you some parenting skills that we think will be helpful for you. And they'd start in on something like communication, for example, between the child and the parent. And the parent would say, wait a minute. That's not my problem right now. My problem right now is discipline. Okay? That's it. And if you're going to talk to me about parenting skills, talk to me about discipline. So we learned that you have to be really flexible in terms of you can't start from lesson 1 to lesson 12. You got to start where the parent is and give them something that's going to work if you're going to keep them engaged and if you're really going to be helpful to these families. What else did we learn? We learned flexible service dollars can be used flexibly to support families and to keep children at home. And we did use them flexibly. We bought car batteries so parents could go to work. We put windows in kids' bedrooms when they had no windows in upstate New York in the winter in their bedroom. We did some of the usual kinds of things about services that there was no other way to pay for, therapeutic camps and those kinds of things at the time, and a number of things like that. We also found that it's difficult to develop and sustain family support groups in rural areas that have weather and geographic challenges. There are mountains in between A and B. It snows in those mountains, and it's really hard sometimes for parents to get together. So we had very, very small family support groups. And if we were ever to do this again, which I don't know if we would, we would have to do a wholly different approach to family support. And now maybe online support would be something that we would try with some of these families. And I already mentioned the family should be the primary determiner of sequencing and using the various program components. Not what we think is good for you now, but what you think is good for you now. Here's the menu. You tell us what it is that you need now to really support you. This one is the saddest thing, I think, about this entire study. And that is, once the kids got out of home into family-based treatment, it was hard to reintegrate them again. They stayed out of home much longer than we really would have liked. Many of them were still out of home at the time that we stopped doing the follow-up at 1 year. So this is an issue, and it's something that I think requires continual monitoring and these kinds of programs. So that's that first study, and that's what really sucked me into being a child mental health services researcher, because I thought it was a really fascinating area, and there was opportunity to do a lot of things that people hadn't done yet. So at the same time, Mary said to me, well, it's about time to apply for the next grant. So the application is still out there. What is it that we could do? And so I decided that the thing that I really wanted to do, because I've been an old emergency room nurse, I've been a nurse in emergency rooms in the Army, had to do with emergency services. I'd done the CPEP study, so why shouldn't I use some of what I knew about that and try and do a randomized controlled trial working out of emergency settings? So working with Roger Boothroyd, who was the project director on this and was the best project director I've ever worked with, and Mary Armstrong, we designed and conducted this randomized controlled trial of three different kinds of in-home crisis services for children in the Bronx that were presenting to psychiatric emergency services and were in need of services that were either not inpatient services, that is, they were at least physically stable and fairly stable psychologically, or outpatient services, meaning that they could wait 6 months for or 6 weeks for a clinic appointment before they were seen and nothing probably terrible would happen to them. So we partnered with the Visiting Nurse Association and the Hispanic Research Center at Fordham in order to conduct this study. I don't have time to go into great detail about the interventions, but let's just say that the standard of treatment at that time in the Bronx was this home-based crisis intervention, which was a home builder's model of family preservation. It had been developed out on the West Coast for children in the child welfare system to try and keep families together. And it was imported to a number of places in New York State, which were very culturally different, and with kids that were probably somewhat different than the kids that had been originally developed for. These caseworkers had two families at a time that they worked with, so it's very intensive in-home. We developed something that we called Home-Based Crisis Intervention Enhanced, or we also called it Turbo HBCI. And we used the things we learned in that first study about some of the things that really worked for families. Respite care, for example, flexible service dollars. We trained our interventionists in cultural competence, and they had regular meetings with folks from the Hispanic Research Center and their consultants, African-American consultants, to really talk about cases to see that if we were being culturally competent in the services we were offering. And we also had a very well-known consultant on violence, violence in communities, violence in homes, to try and help our families. And the final thing was something that our Division of Budget was really fond of thinking about, and that was, can we do this really cheaply without doing two families at a time? Can we take our intensive case managers we already have and decrease their caseloads from 10 to 8, 4 that are in crisis and 4 that are their regular routine case management cases, and give these folks some training in crisis management and see how that works out? So we said, okay, we'll do it. We took in children between 5 and 17 years. They presented at two settings in the Bronx. The parent and the child both had to agree to participate, of course. We have complete data on 238 children and families, and these are the characteristics. They were low income, as you might expect with the Bronx. We were not treating the kids that lived in the northern part of the Bronx in those fancy houses. We were treating the kids from the South and Central Bronx. They had primarily single parent, and the single parent was an unemployed mom. Two-thirds of these kids were Hispanic and one-third were African-American. 46 were rated on a scale that one of our colleagues developed as being dangerous to themselves, and 38% were rated as being dangerous to others. And I've got to tell you that some of these kids, even though I said that, you know, we aren't taking kids that should be in the hospital, some of these kids, in fact, starting with the first kid, had made serious suicide attempts. So these are seriously ill kids, or kids in serious crisis at this point in time, and families that are in crisis because of the nature of the child's behavior. These are the instruments that we used. You can see they're pretty much the same as our first one, although in this case we were very interested also in parental self-efficacy. Does the parent feel that they are competent to really raise this child and deal with the kinds of behavior problems the child is presenting? And also socially supportive behaviors, because we were working in a very, very poor area and we were trying to increase the social supports that individuals would have, particularly through our Turbo intervention where we had a parent advocate working with the interventionist. Here's the data collection. Baseline at the end of the intervention, which was typically 4 to 6 weeks. This is a crisis intervention, and 6 months following the intervention. We did follow-up interviews in the home, and we had bilingual, bicultural interviewers. And here is some idea about the overall outcomes. We took a look at the hospitalization rates of kids in the two hospitals that we were using and compared that to one other hospital in the Bronx that really wanted to have our intervention or our study come to their site. Our study hospitals were admitting kids at the rate of 17% of presenters. Well, at the other hospital, they were admitting 40%. And we saw some of those kids. They were in the emergency room for 24 hours with adult psychiatric patients who were very threatening to some of these kids. I mean, it was an unbelievable situation. 5 to 10% of our kids enrolled required hospitalization. Usually it was a short-term intervention, and they were returned home. And you can see the percent of kids that were in the community at discharge from the intervention, 82% in HBCI, 86% in the Turbo intervention, and 79% in crisis case management. Crisis case managers were more likely to refer kids for hospitalization than were the other interventionists. I don't know how well you can see this one, but it gives some idea about the outcomes. And you can see that we had some improvement across the board in some of the areas, in self-concept, for example. The interesting thing to me was the family adaptability and cohesion. And that is, we targeted, particularly in the home-based crisis intervention and our Turbo intervention in particular, to target families and family support. And you can see that they actually experienced positive support, whereas those in crisis case management did not have the same kind of positive outcome in terms of cohesion. Parental self-efficacy was very positive. Socially supportive behaviors really improved only in the turbo intervention. And we were targeting that specifically in that intervention by using the parent advocate there. So it's pretty much what we expected. But I have to tell you that these are pretty fragile outcomes. And if we continue to do this kind of work, we need to have some kind of step down for this, or we need to have some kind of intermediate supportive services for individuals if we want to continue positive outcomes. Because life happens to these people. Jobs were lost, people moved, life really happens to them. And so we need to be there for them in order to continue with the positive outcomes that we can get during a short-term crisis intervention. The final study that I want to talk about here is something that was, this is the one, Mary, I don't know if you remember this, but we were on the train coming back from the Bronx, I think, and Mary said to me, "Don't panic, but I think that we have another opportunity to do a study. And so maybe we should apply for this study." So I said, okay, as soon as we get the Bronx study stable, we'll think about this other study. And the study was this. In Essex County, New York, which is a very rural county, and it's claim to fame, actually, aside from having the Olympics there, Winter Olympics there one year, is that John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave in Essex County, New York. So don't be fooled by whatever else anyone tells you. I've been there, I've seen it. So they had started, these families got together and said, we have got to help with this system design here. We've got to really put together a family group that can have an important impact on the services that our children receive. And so Mary and I got invited to go up to Essex County and to talk with this family group about what their work was. And it was interesting because when we got there, we got introduced as, these are the people who are going to help you get money to study whether or not this works. And so go ahead and tell us what you're going to do. And I said, well, first of all, I want to know, how will you know you're successful? How will you know Families First in Essex County has really worked? And so they said some of the usual things that we already had in mind, like child symptoms, child functioning. I'm particularly strong in child functioning rather than child symptoms. And they went down the list on some of these things. The child goes to school. Yeah, we agree with that. And then somebody raised their hand and said, I will know that this is successful when I have hope for this child and for my family. And so I said to myself, okay, you ask for it. Now you've got to find some way of measuring this and see whether or not this is true. Okay? So I came home and started looking through the literature to see what we could learn about hope. The Families First in Essex County eventually were able to hire and fire the case managers that their children would be working with. So that's very important. They set up a family drop-in center. They did all kinds of really nice things to provide support services for families. The provider design system of care was in Herkimer County, another very rural county on the other side of the Adirondacks. And they used their resources to establish an innovative educational program for children that had serious emotional disturbances. So here's what happened. Indeed, the parents were right. Okay, we need to listen to parents because they were right. The higher levels of parental hope were associated with better child functioning, independent of which system the child was in. We did a network analysis in this case also, and it indicated that the family organization in Essex County became more central over time. Over the 3 years we were studying them, they became more central to the service delivery system. And I think in part because they did have the ability to hire and fire case managers. Okay, so other people began to treat them in a different way than they would treat them if they were just a family support organization. The provider organization in Herkimer County did not become any more central in the network. It looked just like they looked at the beginning of the study. Mary and I are doing a couple studies now, or we just completed the study. In the meanwhile, I moved from New York State. Okay, the governor lost the election, and I moved from New York State to Florida, as Bill indicated, as did many of us, Roger, Mary, and David, a number of other folks. And Tampa, Florida is kind of the epicenter of the system of care movement. And so we had a system of care studies ongoing down there. And one of our studies in that center, the Research and Training Center for Children's Mental Health, had to do with conducting a study on collaboration within systems of care. And so we did a two-phase, five-year study. Phase one was a national survey of state mental health authorities regarding the existence of systems of care, and we asked folks to please send us all their documents that had to do with establishing systems of care. And phase two used site visits to 10 sites to actually administer a scale designed to measure collaboration within systems of care. 78% of the states responded to us. Of these, 5% said, no, we don't have a system of care, so don't worry about us. For the others, allowing for multiple approaches, they used largely legislation. Some used inducements or capacity building. We'll give you money for intensive case management or for other kinds of services. And 44% used other methods of change. And mostly, the ones that used legislation used other methods of change also. We've just published this in the Journal of Child and Family Studies for any of you that are interested in the outcomes here. What we did when we got all of our data together and we coded it is we did a cluster analysis that produced five clusters of systems of care that used similar kinds of approaches to establishing their system. And in this cluster analysis, one site was selected as the exemplar site by the statistical approach, and then we randomly selected another site in each cluster so that we could look at within cluster and between cluster outcomes. We collected data by interviews, record reviews, observation. We learned a lot by observation, administration of the interagency collaboration scale that had been developed by Paul Greenbaum and Rick Brown. And we used a backward mapping approach, which is often used in policy analysis, and that is when we went into these sites, we started first of all at the local system of care site, and we started with parents. And then we started with their intensive case managers, and then we went to the supervisors, and then we went to the administrators of the system of care. Then we went to the state level, and we looked at the organization at the state level to see what they knew about this system of care and how much they were involved. We had 271 surveys of the instrument that we were using on collaboration, and this is what we found very briefly. The scores on beliefs about system of care were highest, so we're on the same page. We believe in systems of care. It's a good thing to do. Knowledge scores were next. What is a system of care? What are the components? How do they work together? We're not quite as good on that yet. And lowest, as you might expect, were behaviors. Do we act like a system of care? Not necessarily. We know what we should be doing, but that doesn't mean that we always do it. One of the folks that was involved in this project with us and helped to establish the hypotheses was pretty convinced that a bottom-up approach to establishing a system of care was the way to go about things. And what we found was mandates are not bad. Legislation is not bad. It actually helps to make things move forward. So grassroots, no. A top-down approach seemed to work better in most cases than the grassroots approach. Legislation was effective. We've recently put together a manuscript on the qualitative data that we collected, which was considerable and a real effort. And Mary Armstrong is the primary author on that. And it has been submitted for review, so we'll see what happens with that. But one of the other things that we put in here that was not in the collaboration scale is structural and organizational factors that really assist us in affecting collaboration. I think too few of our studies have looked at what I started studying first, the people who are involved in providing services. Not only their characteristics, but the supports that they receive to put those into place, the implementation of these kinds of interventions, and then taking a look at things like collaboration, which is part of everything that's in that black box between the input characteristics of the workers and the program and the child and family and the outcomes that we seek to establish. What we're doing now is a follow-up. When Mary and I were out in the field and we were listening to people talk about collaboration, there's this murmur underneath about conflict. And so we decided that one of the things that we should take a look at is conflict within systems of care. And not only what are the reasons for conflict and how common is it, but how do people go about resolving conflict? And Wei-Jin Chen and Roger Boothroyd are working with me on this study at the present time. And I can only tell you a little bit about this because tomorrow we are going to be presenting this. And so if you want to know about this study, you have to come and listen to us talk about it. But we did a national survey of 88 federally funded systems of care. And we are in the second phase now. We have an idea about what the sources of conflict are and whether or not parents see it the same way as professionals see it, for example. But now we're doing concept mapping in a couple different sites to try and learn more about conflict and its resolution. The eventual idea is to develop an alternate dispute resolution approach that might be used within systems of care and to test it out in a couple sites. Just a little bit on what I'm doing currently. I am Associate Dean for Research in the College of Nursing, and I'm in charge of the PhD program and teach and try to do some research in my spare time. But this is the kind of research I've been working on. Studies such as comparing the outcomes of a cardiac rehabilitation program that's targeted specifically to women versus a cardiac rehab program that's co-ed, which is most common. Most women are not going to cardiac rehab, or if they go to the co-ed program, they don't stay in it. So can we do something more effective for them? The effects of gastric bypass surgery on mineralization in bones. Have I come a long way from children's mental health? These are the kinds of things that I do in addition to trying to keep my focus on children's mental health, because we have no faculty members on our faculty that are interested in children's mental health, and so I'm helping to mentor them to get funding to do some of these other kinds of studies. But I've got to tell you something that we're learning, and that is all of these studies have psychological components associated with them. Gastric bypass surgery? Oh, indeed. Cardiac rehabilitation? Uh-huh. So I'm trying to use some of the skills that I've learned in my mental health research to infuse that into the research that our faculty and students are doing. And finally, about this, according to Erickson, this award and my most recent birthday, which was a stunning one, have caused me to take some steps, I think, in thinking about moving from middle age and its emphasis on productivity to mentoring the next generation, as Bill talked about. And I think that's where I am, and reviewing life accomplishments. Not that I'm about to die anytime soon, I hope, but I think that this is an appropriate place to be at this point in time. Not that I can't be productive, but to really help bring along some younger folks. Because if you look around a lot of these sessions, you'll find that many of us have gray hair or hair that would be gray, whereas there are many fewer younger folks that are really being attracted to this kind of work. And so I think that this is an important issue. The final thing I really want to talk about is, in closing, if I've been successful at all in the work that I've done, it's because of the colleagues that I've worked with. They've been really, really important to me. And in fact, here's one that I want to talk about in particular. I think I'll skip over, given the time, what I think needs to happen in kids' mental health. I can make that available to you because I have a list of those things. But here's Steve Banks. We lost Steve Banks this year in August. Steve Banks was really important to us, to many of us. How many of you have worked with Steve? Yeah, nearly all of you have worked with Steve, and we all miss him. In fact, this morning I got an email message from Joanne Nicholson about the impact is just starting to hit home. I mean, we had the shock first, but now we're learning what it really means to not have Steve to work with us. I got thinking about the enormous impact that he had on my work. And so I went to that CV, and I found that he and I published 8 articles together. We have one that's in progress with Roger and Mary, using some techniques that we published under our article in Untangling the Web. We gave 5 presentations together, and believe it or not, Steve actually got me to go to the American Statistical Association and stand up in front of a bunch of statisticians and give a presentation. I was pretty nervous for that one. And we worked on 10 grants together. And that really underplays his importance in the work that I was doing and the work that you guys were doing, because how often do we stop Steve and say, explain this to me, you know, should I use this approach or that approach, or I'm thinking about this approach, what are the advantages or disadvantages of using this particular approach? And he would spend time with us, and as people have said, never made us feel stupid. He'd say, you present an approach, and he'd say, well, you could do it that way, but you could do it this way, and you knew which approach you should be doing. So I've never heard anyone say a bad word about Steve. He was really a wonderful mentor. I was the mentor in his first award, one of his 2 mentors on his first award, but in truth, he was always my mentor, and so I think we're going to miss him a lot. I'm hoping that one of you out there is either a Steve Banks in development, or that you are a mentor to somebody or will be a mentor to somebody who will be the next Steve Banks. So as I close today's session, I want to indicate that we need to treasure our colleagues. They're really important in the work that we do. They make our work stronger and more relevant, and I'm thankful to all of my colleagues who have made my work more relevant. Thank you.
Continues to be the case. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, everyone. And Mary's final comment, I think it was great that she took a second to acknowledge Steve Banks. This has been an enormous loss for all of us. Some of us have known him. I realized I'd known him for more than a third of my life. And I think this is true of many people here. We, as a section, I think, need to figure out a way to commemorate a guy who has probably been the co-author on more presentations and papers than maybe anyone else in recent years. But thank you, Mary, for taking the time out of your day to acknowledge that. And thank you very much.